welcome to the program. My name is Mike Malloy. This is the Nova M Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in. Scott Ritter is going to join us in about an hour, so stick around for that. And we'll be together this Saturday evening, 6 p.m., February 23rd in Phoenix. You get a chance to meet Scott, and so do I. I get a chance to meet him, too. By God, it just occurred to me. I get a chance to meet him, Kathy. He and I are doing a gig in Phoenix for Nova M Radio and KPHX. If you want information on this, and I hope you do, go to the website, 1480kphx.com. I think there's still tickets available, but you better hurry up. What is this? This is Tuesday, and it's Saturday. Come on, y'all. We have some audio of Bush in Africa over the last couple of days. You don't want to miss it. And you're not going to believe what we've got for you tonight from a concerned citizen in Florida who would rather the schools in that state teach creationism as opposed to evolution because something to do with your pet and oranges, something like Carl Hayes and the Miami Herald columnist and incredibly funny writer couldn't fabricate a character this colorful. Wait till you hear this guy. There are such unfortunate creatures as these roaming free throughout Florida, I've discovered. I've lived there twice, actually three times. And every time I left, I swore I would never go back unless I had the means and method and reason to get the hell out. Now, the Florida panhandle is a little bit different, as long as you don't talk to anybody. You know, the beaches there are great, but you ought to visit Florida sometime if you haven't been down there. It's like an open-air freak museum. And I mean no disrespect to freaks with that comment. Well, we have a lot of listeners in Florida.
You mean former listeners?
Well, I guess they would be former listeners now. To everybody who listens on WINZ, my apologies, unless you're a freak. And if you listen on WINZ, you read Carl Hyacin, and you know what I'm talking about. You know what Florida is, and if you're a retiree, if you come from someplace else and you retire down there, bless your heart. If you are not a retiree and you live there, chances are, and I'm just saying chances are, you're nuttier than a fruitcake. And only out to screw and hustle other people. But that's only, you know, maybe half the population.
And if you do live in South Florida, Cuba Libre!
We'll get to that tonight, too. There was an action by the Supreme Court today that I missed. I didn't see this on any of the network news. Once again, I don't know. Maybe I get too hung up on the Hillary, Obama, Huckabee, McCrazy stories, and I miss this. But the U.S. Supreme Court today threw out a case by journalists and professors to challenge the legality of the warrantless wiretapping program. They threw it out. Back in 2006, journalists and teachers filed a suit against the program, maintaining it violated their right to privacy because they said they had regular contacts with the Middle East and therefore their freedom of expression would be restrained. They specifically targeted the National Security Agency in the case, which had come before the highest court. Now, a lower court in Detroit, a courtroom run by U.S. District Judge Anna Diggs Taylor, initially ordered an end to the program immediately, but the appeals court in July overturned that ruling, saying the plaintiffs had not proved that their foreign communications were being monitored. See, you have to prove that your foreign communications are being monitored, but you can't prove it because the information is classified. You see? Sure you do. Today, the Supreme Court refused to hear the case, as usual, without giving a reason. And that upheld the appeals court ruling, which was that the plaintiffs, all the people involved, couldn't prove that their foreign communications were in fact being monitored. Even though the phone companies are on the record, or somebody is, the Bush crime family, millions, tens of millions of phone calls, practically every single phone call has been monitored since before the attacks on this country. So that's it. Dozens of similar cases have been brought against the National Security Agency, and most have been rejected because the people bringing the action couldn't prove their communications were in fact tapped. Jesus God. Now, the challenge was also brought not just by journalists and attorneys and educators, but several Michigan attorneys and Muslim leaders who thought that they might be the targets of domestic spying by the U.S. government. They claimed that a program by the NSA to eavesdrop on Americans without court approval violated the law and their constitutional rights. So in both instances here, even though I think these cases were combined, they cover a lot of ground. First Amendment rights, Fourth Amendment rights, and Fifth Amendment rights. And the U.S. Supreme Court effectively said today, screw that. Get out of here. Get your case out of here. Go away. Michael Steinberg, legal director for the Michigan chapter of the ACLU, said, quote, it's a sad day for civil liberties when the president violates the fundamental rights of U.S. citizens and the court declines to address the issue or serve as a check on the abuse of power. You know, we really are sitting on top of a powder keg in this country. No, the trains haven't started yet. The cattle cars haven't been rolling. The concentration camps are still sitting there waiting for the first arrivals. And other than liberals in general, nobody in this country has been targeted the way the trade unionists were targeted, and then the communists were targeted, and then finally the Jews were targeted in Germany, and then the Nazis moved against the Jews and the rest of them. Regardless of that, though, those facts, we are sitting on top of a powder keg. Everything has been put in place to deny, I mean, ruling after ruling after ruling, whether it comes in signing statements or inactivity by the Congress or refusals to hear a case in the Supreme Court or actual rulings by the Supreme Court. Everything is in place that with the slightest puff of wind, this fascist house of cards is going to come just absolutely tumbling down. And that's it. And the ball game's over. They have kicked the basic foundations of a democratic republic, they've kicked those foundations out from under the Constitution, the way our documents read, but the way we actually govern ourselves. You look at the Padilla case, you look at the case of the so-called Liberty City 7, you look at case after case after case that has occurred. And all of it in the name of this phony ass thing that the Bush crime family came up with after they engineered the attack on this country, and that is the war on terror. The war on terror, which is a nonsense statement to begin with. It's like something out of Lewis Carroll. How do you make war on a concept? You can't do that. You can go after criminals who attack your country. Oh, well. Astonishing. As you know now, after almost 50 years, I was in high school when Cuba came to power, or when Castro came to power, and we actually cheered our American history teacher who, I think we were right in sections of American history where fascism almost gobbled up this country back in the several times in our history, but especially back in the late 20s, early 30s. And that's what we were studying in American history when news came that Castro had defeated the tyrant, the real terrorist, the dictator, Fulgencio Batista. And Castro identified himself as an agrarian reformer. More on that in a second. I'm Mike Molloy. This is Nova M.
Mike Malloy.
Well, believe it or not, NBC is calling the Wisconsin primary with 0% of the precincts reporting. They're calling it for Barack Obama. Barack Obama has 3,815 votes counted so far. Hillary Clinton has 3,578. I don't know how NBC does that, but they must be right. They are mainstream media, right? Of course, McCain, there's no question McCain's going to win in Wisconsin. Anyway, Castro, after 49 years, it seems like just yesterday when we were cheering him in our high school American history class, we were absolutely thrilled that Barack Obama, oh, God, come on, Mike, that, who am I talking about? Fidel Castro, the agrarian reformer, had defeated the dictator and mafia connection freak, Fulgencio Batista. And then, of course, Castro made his fateful trip to the United Nations in New York in what, the next year, 60 or 61, where he declared himself an absolute communist. And then because at that point, then the U.S. decided and maintained this decision for the next five decades to isolate Cuba, which was insane, utterly insane. Okay, granted, it was at the height of the Cold War, but once we came to we should have come to realize that Castro was as much of a threat to the United States as the Dominican Republic. But no, we had to maintain it. And then, of course, the deal with the devil, Khrushchev, was made between Castro and Khrushchev and the missiles and the Cuban Missile Crisis and on and on and on and on. Of course, that was after we attempted to invade Cuba. A plan that Kennedy inherited from Eisenhower, the attempted invasion of Cuba with Cuban exiles, supporters of Fulgencio Batista. So, of course, Castro responded by cutting a deal with the devil. I mean, if you can't trust this behemoth to your north, 60 miles north of you, what the hell are you going to do? Oh, it just goes on and on. I don't know. So all the presidential candidates issued a statement. Obama said the United States should be ready to normalize relations with Cuba and ease the trade embargo of the last 50 years if the Cuban leadership, quote, begins opening Cuba to meaningful democratic change, end quote. You better be careful, Senator Obama, because every time an American leader says something like that and the country does open itself to change and we don't like the change, we usually go in then and start killing and bombing or imposing sanctions or otherwise screwing with the internal policies of that country. So be careful, Senator Obama. I'm sure, even though you're a very young man, I'm sure you've seen examples of that, haven't you? Barack Obama also said the resignation by Fidel Castro should mark the end of a dark era in Cuba's history. I don't know if the Cuban people would say it's a dark era, but okay. He went on to say the proper release of all prisoners of conscience wrongly jailed for standing up for the basic freedoms too long denied to the Cuban people would mark an important break with the past. That's true. Any totalitarian regime locks up prisoners of conscience. In this country, we don't call them prisoners of conscience. We call them terrorists, and we lock them up in the same manner. And for the most part, what we do is scoop people up from other countries and then torture them. So for any American politician at this point in our history to point fingers at Cuba and say J'accuse is just a bit disingenuous, wouldn't you think? Well, I think. McCain called for the release of prisoners, cautioning that, quote, freedom for the Cuban people is not yet at hand, end quote. McCain said Cuba's transition to democracy is inevitable. Blah, blah, blah. Hillary Rodham Clinton said she would. What? Hillary Rodham Clinton said, do you have her statement? Hillary Rodham Clinton said in a statement, that as president, she would, quote, push Cuba now to join the community of nations and become a democracy, end quote. Senator Clinton, Cuba is already in the community of nations. It's not in the community of nations where we live. Most countries around the world, believe it or not, Senator Clinton and Jesus, God, if you don't know this, why are you running for president? Most nations around the world have relations with Cuba. Canada has relations with Cuba. Mexico has relations with Cuba. Those are those two big countries to the north and south of us, Senator Clinton. Duh. Am I being a smartass right now? Yes. But anytime a politician makes a statement like that, it brings out the smartass in me. Mike Huckabee, the Christian, said, quote, until Fidel Castro is dead, there could be no significant movement toward reform in Cuba, end quote. Leave it to the Christian to say something like that, right? Jesus, God. So as far as I'm concerned, all four of you get a massive F. I would have loved to have seen one American politician say something to the effect, okay, as a result of 50 years of crushing sanctions against this little island country to the south of us, some of the what we consider to be basic freedoms have been abrogated by the dictator Fidel Castro. Some of those freedoms were abrogated after we tried to invade his country, after we tried numerous times to poison him, to kill him. So let's apologize for 50 years of misguided policy in Cuba and ask Raul Castro to release the political prisoners. Wouldn't that have been better? The hell with it.
Tell me what's the word, a word of.
We cannot let terrorists and rogue nations hold this nation hostile or hold our allies hostile.
This is a guy who couldn't get a U.S. visa. Carlos Varela, Cuban. Well, I guess not. You can tell by the music. He's, .25 before the hour. Barry reminds me, we don't have to look at Jose Padilla as a political prisoner. Don Siegelman, the former governor of Alabama, is a political prisoner. And there is another political prisoner in Alabama now. Can't think of her name. But we lock up governors. I guess Castro has done that, too, in his attempts to maintain full, complete control of his power. But I all my life, literally, since I consider myself able to think, which would be just about the high school years, I've watched our policies toward Cuba, and they were insane. And I don't care who the president was, the policies towards Cuba were absolutely insane. Now, I realize we have a lot of Cuban Americans who listen to this program in South Florida, and this is where I disagree completely with them. Well, what the hell, I disagree mostly with them anyway. But whatever. Cindy's eyes, a couple of people who, I mentioned this the other night, that her eyes, all of a sudden I noticed her eyes had a reptilian look, and I didn't mean that as an insult. I meant it as an observation. It was just like, the woman has reptilian eyes. She just does. And now Insane McCain apparently has turned her loose on Michelle Obama. That makes a lot of sense. So, the prim and proper Stepford wife going after the Ivy League educated attorney. But that's Republican. That's the way the Republicans do it. Suzanne in L.A. writes in, Mike, there was something about Cindy McCain that creeped me out, too. Now that I see her standing by her man today as he declares victory in Wisconsin, I think it's this. She is the Southwest Stepford wife. It's the not a hair out of place, the desert lizard eyes, the size 2, and her general programmed persona. Yeah, it is. You know me. I make ad hominem attacks all the time. That's just part of what I do, and I thoroughly enjoy it. So I guess it's incorrect to say ad hominem if it's a woman you're talking about, right? What would it be?
You're the Latin expert in the family, so.
Well, not now.
I beg.
I bet I get three or four answers to this real quick, and I can tell you that three or four people are going to email in. What is the female equivalent in Latin of ad hominem?
Wouldn't it be ad homina? I have no idea. Ad hominix? But I'll tell you what, she does remind me exactly, and I dressed up like this for Halloween one year in high school,
yeah.
Exactly of that lead alien on that TV miniseries V.
V, yeah.
Yeah, the ones that had the lizard skin under the human masks. That was such a great movie.
Yeah, it was.
I still remember the theme song. It was just this very industrial sounding.
Have you still got that costume?
I wish I did.
That would be fun.
I know.
Oh, never mind. Art from Manhattan writes in about Cindy's eyes and says, check out the short video at TPM. He writes, those eyes. On a more serious note, I look forward to listening to you and Scott, and I'm sure you're fully prepped for it. But then he comes up with a couple of questions, and I'll be happy to do that, Art. As soon as Scott gets here, which will be, in about a half an hour. Well, not here, I mean on the program. This cracks me up. Australia's new immigration minister, you know there's a new government in Australia. They got rid of the conservative proto-Nazi John Howard and his gang. The new immigration minister told a Senate committee today that he felt he had too much power. And he was uncomfortable, quote, playing God, end quote, with people's lives. His name is Chris Evans. He's the immigration minister, and his statement came after a series of scandals over the treatment of immigrants by John Howard's government. Mr. Evans said there had been a big increase in ministerial intervention in individual migration cases during the Howard government, and in some cases people had no right to appeal. Gosh, that sounds like here. Mr. Evans said, quote, I have formed the view that I have too much power, end quote. He went on to say, I am uncomfortable with that, not just because of concern about playing God, but also because of the lack of transparency and accountability for the decisions that are made on the ministerial level, end quote. Mr. Evans' predecessor, the one from the John Howard government last year, used his powers to revoke the visa of an Indian doctor, Muhammad Hanif, and force him to leave the country even after what appears to be a trumped-up terrorist charge against him was dismissed. And that followed concern about Mr. Howard's government's deportation to Serbia of a man who had never lived there and was a permanent resident of Australia. His name was Robert Jovicic. He had lived in Australia since the age of 2. After being born to Serbian parents in France, he was deported in June 2004 after committing a string of minor offenses in Australia. He had never set foot in Serbia. He was unable to speak the language, and he found himself homeless in sub-zero temperatures. This is typically the moves of a conservative prime minister, isn't it? Anyway, he was left homeless in sub-zero temperatures during the winter in Belgrade, so he staged a protest vowing to die on the steps of the Australian embassy in Belgrade, and finally was allowed to return in February last year on a two-year visa back to the country that he's lived in for 36 years. Oh, my God. So Barack Obama is the winner in Wisconsin. I would imagine it's getting difficult. They had some live footage here of Hillary speaking in Youngstown, Ohio. Youngstown, Ohio. Oh, my God. Again, when I was a kid growing up, Youngstown was just a perfect little town. If you didn't, you know, breathe in too deeply, it was the actual heart and soul of the rubber industry in this country, tires, Youngstown, Ohio. Factories, every place you looked, everybody worked. And again, it was a great upbringing if you didn't breathe in too deeply and didn't pay any attention to what 50 years down the road your industries were doing to the environment. But aside from that, Youngstown, Akron, all of those areas, Toledo, Springfield, Dayton, they were Lima, Findlay, they were all great little towns to grow up in, or small cities. And so Hillary is in Youngstown, and she must be aware of what is happening in Wisconsin. And once again, the reports I heard were that in this primary, the turnout of registered Democrats exceeded anything anyone thought was going to happen. And this keeps happening. And that's a good thing, obviously. It's a good thing. But the more those numbers increase in terms of primaries, the more they seem to work against, at this stage, Hillary Clinton. Huh? You agree? Don't agree? I guess it really doesn't matter, right? One last thing here. And then, do you have that? Do you have the audio of the guy in Florida? Okay. Let me get this first. The health minister in Indonesia says the United States is part of a global conspiracy now to profit from the spread of avian flu, and that the United States might be using samples of this virus to produce biological weapons. Now, this is the level to which we have sunk around the world. This is reported by the Sydney Morning Herald in Australia. The Indonesian health minister is one Dr. Siti Supari. She claims that even though she's worried about the U.S., she's agreed to share virus samples and allow all nations access to resulting vaccines. However, Indonesia is still blocking sharing samples from human victims. And she has written a book, and she said in the book that the World Health Organization laboratories forwarded influenza viruses to Western companies so that they could profit by selling vaccines back to developing countries. She says in her book, quote, "The system of world health management has been very exploitative. It has been controlled by inhumanly desires based on the greediness to raise capital and to control the world," end quote. Also, she says in her book that some Indonesian samples were sent to a U.S. Defense Department laboratory. And she writes that, quote, "Some of our seed viruses had been in a laboratory known as a facility for developing biological weapons in a superpower country," end quote. And the president of Indonesia appears to have endorsed the book because he wrote the introduction. This is how we're looked at now. Huh? How about that?
Childhood memories saw the swirl pass like the wind through the trees. Hey, oh, where to go?
Flying monkey free zone.
Ten before the hour. All right, Felix in Madison, Wisconsin, explained it to me. Homonym, as in ad hominem, is the accusative form of the Latin noun homo, which is often interpreted as man. Although that in the generalized meaning of man to mean a human being. So ad hominem can apply to a woman as is. The Latin word for an actual male man would be vir or weir. Yeah, that's the Vulgate, the way we were taught to pronounce it, weir. Thanks, Felix. So ad hominem attack on the part of your humble and obedient servant here against Hillary Clinton. The term was, or against Cindy McCain was perfectly appropriate, in at least in the usage. Today, Florida's Board of Education voted 4-3 to change standards for teaching science in Florida's public schools. That's according to Miami Herald. They report the following, quote, "For the first time ever, evolution is to be taught clearly and explicitly in Florida classrooms now that the Florida Board of Education today approved a batch of new science standards that actually says the E word, evolution." Notice how close the vote was, 4-3. But there's a catch. Evolution will be taught as, quote, "the scientific theory of evolution." And according to, where'd I get this? Think Progress. Previously, Florida science standards referred to evolution as, quote, "biological changes over time," end quote. The shift to evolution, the word evolution, was widely embraced by Florida scientists, school teachers, university professors. Yet a successful lobbying campaign by a coalition of conservative groups like the Christian Coalition of Florida and the Florida Family Policy Council managed to convince the school board to insert that little caveat that it's the scientific theory of evolution. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. These groups said they were, quote, "vigorously opposed," end quote, to the evolution language because it, quote, "clashes with their religious convictions or their personal beliefs that evolution has not been proved," end quote. End quote. What I would say to these people is, why don't you take your children the hell out of the public school system then? Jesus God, so to speak. Why not just send them to a Christian school or a Jewish school or a Muslim school or a Seventh-day Adventist school or a Baha'i school or a Hindu school or years of evolutionless education have biased Florida residents. A recent St. Petersburg Times poll of Florida residents found that, quote, only 22% want public schools to teach an evolution-only curriculum, while 50% want only faith-based theories such as creationism taught. Well, here's a guy, excuse me, a guy from the Florida Panhandle addressed the Board of Education when they were taking hearings on this. And he held up two oranges, and he said the following.
Maybe have a household pet, or maybe some of the other board members, maybe a house.
Oh, wait a minute. Where are we?
Thank you, sir. Before I begin, I'd like to know maybe if any of you maybe have a household pet, or maybe some of the other board members, maybe a household pet at home, or maybe somebody here. See, I brought these oranges down here with me. I was going to eat them, but after reading all the material I've read this last weekend, I've learned from some of the writings that, and I'm just convinced, I know beyond the shadow of a doubt, this orange right here is the first cousin of somebody's pet cat. And this orange here, I'm convinced, just because I've got a conviction, all I've learned within, now I know this orange here is no doubt the parent of somebody's pet dog. And I wondered, would you agree with me, Commissioner, these are related to human beings? You know what? I've read, and I'm happy to report, that evolution supports my belief that these oranges are, in fact, related to human beings.
Amen.
In 1859, in fact, Charles Darwin wrote in his book called Origin of Species, he wrote on page 176 something that proves that I'm telling you the truth. He said, "It's a truly wonderful fact that all animals and all plants throughout all time and space are related to each other."
Oh.
So you see, I have irrefutable evidence that these oranges are, in fact, related to somebody's pets.
Oh.
And if you don't believe that, well, deep down inside, you really don't believe in evolution.
This guy votes. This guy votes. This guy may be driving down the road on some two-lane highway in the Florida Panhandle as you're going the other way, and at the last minute decide that he wants to go see Jesus and swerves over the yellow line and wipes out you and your family so he can go see Jesus. Oranges and house pets. Well, they are related, you dumbass. It's something called Well, what's it called, Kathy? Quick. Molecular structure, atomic structure, DNA, the web of life, the tapestry of being. Oh, my God. But that's the kind of people that... well, you know. And the last one here before the break, you ever heard of Robert Sommer? He's a federal judge. He worked in private practice for years in Boston before he was appointed to the bench by President Bush in December 2004. I guess I don't have time to tell the story. I'll tell it when we come back after we talk with who we talking with Scott Ritter. So hang around for that. And then we're going to talk a little bit about Federal Judge Robert Sommer, who was stopped when his Mercedes hit a pickup truck about 11:30 at night a week or two ago. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Welcome back. It's about 7 past the hour. Scott Ritter is a former Marine, combat veteran, also a UN weapons inspector. During the 90s, he was also one of the first people to warn the American public that what was being presented as fact to the American public by more than just the Bush administration, I believe also including the Clinton administration, was not in fact. Scott Ritter joins us now. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Looking forward to seeing you Saturday night in Phoenix. I'm not sure what they're going to have us do. Hopefully it's not a death cage match.
No, I think it's going to be another public venue, opportunity to...
To talk about the reality.
To have a discussion, a debate, dialogue with people about issues that, you know, mainstream media and American politicians seem to be loath to discuss.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be an interesting time. I want to ask you a couple of questions because your knowledge of the situation, various situations in the Middle East, certainly exceeds mine and probably exceeds most Americans. The Iranian oil bourse, this new oil exchange that is scheduled to begin trading in euros sometime in late March, which obviously is going to have, I think most people agree, is going to have the wrong sort of effect on the dollar. What will opening this bourse have to do with U.S. policy where it concerns Iran? That's A. And B, isn't this what Saddam Hussein had in mind prior to the invasion?
Well, let's first of all start with the Saddam linkage. Saddam's decision, first of all, he didn't create a bourse per se. You know, Saddam's ability to export oil was limited to the oil for food agreement, meaning that he had to have all oil exports approved by the United Nations Security Council, and that all funds were transferred to a French bank where they would be dispersed by you know, a committee set up for that purpose. Saddam was extremely frustrated by the fact that this committee was controlled by primarily the United States and Great Britain, who put holds on Iraqi requests for goods, holds totally to the billions of dollars. So in an effort to exact revenge, Saddam insisted that a certain percentage of his oil that would be sold via the Oil for Food program would be sold in euros. And the whole purpose of this was to create a problem for the French bank, because now they would have to convert dollars into euros, and there was a tremendous loss of funds. Saddam was frustrated that his money was going to a French bank and was being used by the Security Council to fund, for instance, the inspection programs. Mm-hmm. He viewed this as a windfall profit taking by the West at his expense. And so what he did in seeking to have a portion of the oil proceeds transacted in euros was basically create a money handling nightmare for the West, a far cry from what the Iranians are talking about doing. Mm-hmm. The Iranians, contrary to popular belief, are having extremely difficult economic times right now. They are completely dependent upon the income derived through the export of oil for their economic well-being. They have been hampered by economic sanctions unilaterally imposed by the United States for a number of decades, and now these sanctions that are imposed by the Security Council. And they're further hampered by the fact that what energy they are able to sell is being sold in dollars, and the dollar is an increasingly weak currency on the foreign exchange. So the Iranians aren't getting the biggest bang for their buck. The Iranians are simply saying, look, we need to maximize our economic potential here. The dollar is failing us, and we have no reason to support and continue to prop up the dollar given the policies of the United States of America. And so I think the Iranians are doing something which they deem to be not only in their best economic interest, but also from a diplomatic interest, they see as a reprisal for what the United States has been doing to them for a number of decades. Will this go over well? Absolutely not. Will it change America's policy towards Iran? No. The policy of the United States is regime change. It has been for a number of years. All this will do is reinforce in the minds of those in Washington, D.C., who are proponents of regime change, the necessity to accelerate the pace of regime change. Mm-hmm. This does create the dangerous conditions that could lead to military action in the near future.
Do you see a change in policy toward Iran if a Democratic administration takes over?
It depends on who is the Democratic administration. We already know that, we were wrong to hope for much from the Democrats in general. The Democrats took control of Congress. There was this talk of, the anti-war Democratic Party, and they floundered when it comes to Iraq. They've all but rubber-stamped the potential of war with Iran. So any change will have to come from an individual. And so we have two individuals at play here. One is Hillary Rodham Clinton. The other is Barack Obama. And I think Hillary Clinton has made it quite clear in her statements, her speeches, et cetera, that she is a proponent of a hardline stance against Iran. And while she, like others, say that all options are on the table, her articulation of Iran as a problem tends to resemble that of a nail. Therefore, the only option to solve a problem that's defined as a nail becomes the hammer. Barack Obama at least has had the courage, and I acknowledge that it was a courageous statement to talk about the need for a Muslim summit, the need to sit down and talk, and more importantly, listen to what others around the world say, inclusive of the Iranians. So I think a Barack Obama administration is America's best hope for a nonviolent resolution to our difficulties with Iran.
Do you have an opinion as to where certain high command members of the U.S. military stand where it concerns war or an invasion or an assault, I guess would be the proper word, an air assault against Iran, given that a lot has been batted around non-mainstream media about just that topic, that the the new head of the admiral who's in charge of that part of the world has made it clear, if we can believe some of the quotes, that he is not interested in getting involved in an assault against Iran, although it's not really ultimately his decision. And also I've heard again through sources that use the internet that some of the members of the Joint Chiefs are totally against this because of what has happened to the U.S. military under Bush. Do you have an opinion on all that?
Yeah, it's the problem is there's no such thing as a unified, homogeneous military. Mm-hmm. Where everybody there's a singular point of view. Admiral Fallon, who is the Navy admiral you spoke of, the commander of Central Forces Command, has been articulate on a number of occasions saying that a war with Iran wasn't going to happen on his watch. But you rightly note that he doesn't get to make that ultimate decision. He can influence that, and he has done so in the past when Dick Cheney tried to slip in a third carrier battle group. Mm-hmm. About a year ago, Fallon rejected it, saying, look, there's no military reason for this carrier to be here, and therefore I don't want it here. And unless you directly order me to take it, I'm going to reject it. And off it went. But as soon as he made his statement that a war with Iran wasn't going to happen on his watch, something happened. His phone rang. And the next thing you know, Admiral Fallon is traveling around the Middle East as America's representative, meeting with heads of state, giving a message that said Iran is a great threat that must be dealt with, and that that the United States was looking to its allies to stand with America in confronting the Iranians. Fallon takes orders, and he needs to. Our Constitution dictates that the military is controlled by the civilian leadership. Now, there is a split in the military, and it's an interesting split. The Army and the Marine Corps seem to be dead set against military misadventure in Iran, mm-hmm. because the Army and the Marine Corps has paid a horrific price for the folly of invading Iraq. They're horribly overstretched. They simply don't have the resources not only to continue the mission in Iraq, but to expand their Middle East mission by going in to Iran. On the other hand, the Navy and the Air Force have a completely different perspective. First of all, they're fighting for budget dollars. The Air Force is saying that it's $80 billion short of mm-hmm. where it needs to be. The Navy is desperate to hold on to its 300-ship fleet in this day of budgetary excess and the need for cuts. And both the Navy and the Air Force are saying, look, we can handle Iran. The Air Force wants to prove that air power is indeed a critical factor in the future of American military planning. They view Iran as a wonderful opportunity to demonstrate that. And the Navy doesn't want to let the Air Force steal the show, so the Navy is talking about what it can bring to bear in terms of carrier battle groups, cruise missiles, etc. So far from being split, far from being unified on opposition to an Iranian misadventure, I think the military is decidedly split. And the problem with being split like this is that politicians tend to listen to those people who are in agreement with them. And unless the military presents a unified face of disagreement, you're going to have people say, look, the military says they can do this. What they mean is the Air Force and the Navy say they can do this.
That comes through loud and clear. Scott, can you hold on a second? We have to take a break here. Can you stick around a little bit? Where'd he go? You got him. Hey, Scott?
Yeah.
You can stick around?
Yes, sir.
Okay, let me put you on hold. We'll come back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. We're talking with Scott Ritter, former Marine and UN weapons inspector. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
through a hole in the air from those Nats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from
23 past the hour. We're talking with Scott Ritter. You know who he is. Scott, going back to the question about the Iranian oil bourse and what Saddam did by switching a certain amount of the oil for food program into euros, to any extent, did that action by Saddam Hussein precipitate the invasion?
No, that invasion was locked in, independent of Saddam's decision to jerk the bank around through the converting dollars to euros. This was a bigger picture than just the oil. And I would say the same thing is true about Iran. The decision's already been made by those people who are proponents of action against Iran. And it's a decision that's made independent of whatever Iran decides to do with the dollar or with the bourse.
Using or drawing on your experience, both as a Marine and as a UN weapons inspector, and as someone who knows that part of the world and U.S. policy, what would you say is a reasonable approximation of our getting involved in yet another military action against?
Well, it's the Bush administration is desperate to look for some sort of justification for initiating action. I mean, for all that the Air Force and the Navy want to go to war with Iran, there is strong opposition in the U.S. military. The military is broke. Our nation is broke, both fiscally and morally. I mean, we're taking huge hits abroad. We're not a nation that's that's getting the respect it enjoyed at one time. Bush is not. It's not as easy as him just snapping his finger and saying, let's go do this. He's looking for some sort of trigger, a justification. And, I'm not saying that there's going to be a false flag, but let's take a look at what happened last week. In Damascus, a car bomb goes off, killing someone named Imad Mughniyeh, a man who the United States labels as one of the greatest masterminds of terror in the modern world. What this has done is set off a cry for revenge on the part of not only Hamas, but Hezbollah in Lebanon. That could create a, spiraling out of control of a cause and effect relationship. Let's say that Hezbollah works with Hamas to strike Israel. Israel strikes Hezbollah, expanding the conflict that draws in Iran, and now the United States has its trigger moment.
Right.
It's hard to say exactly when Bush, or even if Bush, will go to war against Iran. What I can say is he desperately wants to, and more importantly, his vice president, perhaps the most powerful person in the United States of America today, desperately wants to. And the president, Bush, gave the vice president almost absolute control over the national and national security and foreign policy mechanisms of this nation by executive order in April 2001. Vice president is perhaps the only voice that counts. People keep talking about, Mr. Gates in defense and a voice of moderation, how Condi Rice might be a little bit moderate today. They're irrelevant. The vice president is the voice that matters, and his voice is screaming at the top of his lungs.
Yeah.
Take on Iran.
It's all Dick Cheney. I've got a break here again. It's about a 6-minute break. Can you stick around for one more segment?
Sure.
Okay. Let me put you on hold. We'll come back right after the break. We're talking with Scott Ritter. We'll continue the conversation right after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
I have paid my debt. Now won't you leave me in my misery? Trouble, trouble, please be kind. I don't want no fight, and I haven't got a lot of time. We'll be right back.
It's about 25 before the hour. Continuing our discussion with Scott Ritter, with whom I'm going to be in Phoenix this Saturday night, February 23rd, 6 p.m., sponsored by KPHX and Nova M Radio. So if you haven't gotten a ticket yet, please do so. Go to the website 1480kphx.com for information. Scott, I have a question for you that is just, I feel like an idiot asking it, but the other night, in some sort of discussion on this program, I had a phone call from somebody who, and this has happened over the past 5 or 6 years, somebody who insists that the weapons of mass destruction were actually in Iraq until they were trucked out into Syria. Now, no matter what you say to these people about U.S. satellite surveillance, how an action like that would be picked up by intelligence agencies all over the world, you still get this. Can you just make a comment about that, please, and also about the fact that I believe was it not the Clinton administration that first pulled out inspectors, and then the Bush administration did the same. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, it's a fallacy to say that Saddam kicked out inspectors. Inspectors were ordered out in December 1998 by Bill Clinton on the eve of a 72-hour bombing campaign, which the United States used not to get rid of WMD, but to try and assassinate Saddam Hussein. And they used intelligence information gathered by the inspectors to carry this out. And the Iraqis said, well, then the inspectors are no longer welcome back in our country. They did let them back in 2002. And the inspectors immediately turned around and contradicted with factually based evidence all the assertions put forward by the Bush administration that Iraq had reconstituted a WMD manufacturing capability. But again, the Bush administration ordered the inspectors out on the eve of their invasion of Iraq in March of 2003. Now, you know, people grasp at anything, and I think there's enough people who don't want to believe that we were lied to by the Bush administration, and so they're willing to accept any rumor, any speculation, including the fanciful notion that these WMDs were trucked out of Iraq and sent to Lebanon and Syria and are now buried in the desert somewhere, you know, waiting for some inopportune time in the future when terrorists will get their hands on them and attack us. I don't know what they think. I would say this. A, there's no evidence whatsoever to sustain any single one of these assertions. There's no evidence that would that would fit the definition of fact. B, you can't hide what you haven't produced. And what I remind people is that we had a material balance of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction up to 1998. So in order for Iraq to have WMD that was moved in 2002, 2003, they would have had to reconstitute this manufacturing capability. And the United States is in complete possession of the Iraqi factories where this reconstitution would have had to occur. And the CIA using, believe me, the CIA was desperate to prove that Iraq had these WMDs. And the CIA subjected these facilities to the most intrusive, extensive forensic investigation possible. And no evidence of this reconstitution could be found. So the bottom line is, there were no WMDs to transport. I can say that till I'm blue in the face, and these people will blink at me dumbly and go, well, they put them on trucks. That's why you didn't find them. Hey,
I know,
sorry about that.
It must be, it's, for someone like you, I know it is for me, it's monumentally frustrating for me. It must be, I don't know how you deal with those questions, having been there, having been part of the inspections program. Another question, the Israel factor, if you can elaborate a bit based on your knowledge of this, where it concerns a possible attack against Iran, to what extent do you think that either A, Israel is involved in pressing that kind of agenda, or B, is impeding it, or C, would just react if they were attacked?
Well, A, if Israel was attacked, Israel would react. There's no doubt about that.
Right.
Israel has a legitimate right of self-defense, and I think Israel learned in 1991 when Iraq fired missiles against Israeli soil that it can't rely on the United States to prevent these attacks. We fought a war that liberated Kuwait, but we didn't stop Iraq's ability to continue to launch missiles into Israel. So in the future, in any future conflict that has the potential of missiles impacting Israeli soil, I think Israel will say, look, we're going to let the IDF defend us, not American military. Mm-hmm. In that regard, Israel is also a very small country that has a zero tolerance for any potential of nuclear weapons that could destroy their very existence. And so the Israelis have been very articulate about the need to confront Iran and their perceived nuclear weapons program. Israel, again, is not able to provide any evidence that such a program exists, but Israel doesn't want to take any chances. And Israel has been, since 2002, pushing aggressively for military action on the part of the United States against Iran. The Israeli government has shared targeting data, has shared concepts on how Iran could be attacked, and at every opportunity, senior Israeli government officials are saying that the military option is the only way that you're going to resolve this problem, that you must destroy Iran's nuclear infrastructure. So the Israelis are very much behind the push for a war against Iran. To what extent this Israeli pressure influences the Bush administration policies is hard to say, because while there is a great sympathetic ear in the Bush administration for Israel, I think the United States has larger objectives at play here than simply securing Israeli, Israel. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, implementation of a policy of regional transformation, regional domination that seeks to leverage control over Middle East oil, Central Asian oil, so that we can, control the pace of Chinese and Indian economic development, the world's two largest developing economies that are virtually addicted to Middle Eastern and Central Asian oil. We're very concerned 20 to 30 years down the road that these two economies will eclipse our own and threaten our hold on global power. And so, there's that element to play here. It's a complicated thing, but the bottom line is we can say that Israel's position parallels the Bush administration's position insofar that the Islamic regime in Tehran must go, and Israel is lobbying very hard for America to take actions that will achieve that outcome.
The alleged terrorist that was assassinated in Syria the other day was, alleged, and I use that term advisedly, but alleged to have been behind the Marine Barracks bombing in Beirut in, when was that, 82? There was, just prior to that bombing in Lebanon, the attack by the Israelis against the French-built nuclear plant near Baghdad. I forget the name of it.
The Osirak plant.
Two-part question here. Do you see that kind of an Israeli strike into Iran? And the second part is, do you think the attack on the Marine barracks in Lebanon had any connection there, or was that just simply a matter of the Lebanese civil war?
Well, two issues. One, Israel, took out Osirak because Israel believed that the Iraqi government was going to use it as a research and development facility to create enriched uranium usable in a nuclear weapon. What we know as weapons inspectors is that there was no Iraqi nuclear program until Israel bombed Osirak. And then once Israel bombed it, the Iraqis said, we need to have a deterrent to prevent this from happening again. And the nuclear program took off. Nobody seems to talk about that.
Right.
But the fact is, Israel got away with a one-of right there. They can't repeat that against Iran. First of all, the distances that they were talking about are much greater. Iran's ability to defend itself is far greater than what Iraq had in 1982, 1983. Israel can't sustain this force. I mean, it's not just flying one airplane in and dropping a bomb. You've got to go in and clear the airspace. You've got to refuel. You've got to loiter while you acquire targets. All of this requires, a significant amount of aircraft, because you're not just talking about hitting one target. You got to hit 12 targets in, geographically distant areas. Israel simply doesn't have the military capacity to do this whatsoever. The only nation that can do it is the United States, which is why Israel is aggressively lobbying for American military action. Mm-hmm. Now, the Marine barracks, I think what we have to recognize is that the United States had intervened in Lebanon as a humanitarian gesture, that is to provide a military buffer between the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which needed to evacuate Beirut, and the IDF, which was bombarding Beirut. Then we stayed on, ostensibly as a stability force, but we ended up taking sides in the Lebanese Civil War. We sided with what, you know, a militia group we called the Lebanese Government. They might be called the Lebanese Government, but they were just another militia taking on, other militias, Amal, the Druze, etc.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we became occupiers. And this gentleman, I use that name in quotations, the person who was killed, Imad Mugnea, was part of an organization called Islamic Jihad, which had sworn that they were going to drive all occupiers, Israeli, American, and French, out of Lebanon. And the tactic they chose was to use a method of warfare that the United States military supremacy couldn't counter, and that is, you know, car bombs, truck bombs, suicide bombs, and they're very effective. Within a few months after the bombing, within a year or so, America was out of Lebanon. Because we recognized that we weren't going to gain anything by staying in Lebanon. That's the bottom line. Do I condone what he did? Absolutely not. As a former Marine, you know, he killed 241 of my fellow Marines.
Right.
I condemn the action wholeheartedly, but I understand why it took place. And I think we need to need to recognize that there are cause and effect relationships at play here, and that when we go out and push our weight around, Newton's second law of physics applies to diplomacy and the military as well. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And if we behave irresponsibly, we can expect an irresponsible action to come our way.
Well, Scott, listen, I appreciate your answers to the questions tonight. A lot of those questions came from people who knew we were going to be on the program and sent me some emails. And I'm really looking forward to Saturday night and what will happen when you and I sit there and have a discussion with the audience that is going to be at this gig sponsored by Nova M. So until then, listen, take care, and I'll see you Saturday night. Thanks for coming on the program tonight. Okay,
hey, thanks for having me. I look forward to it.
All right, Scott. Take care.
Bye.
We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
Crusade, this war on terrorism, this is a new kind of evil.
New kind of evil. All right, let's do, we'll talk about old Judge Sama here in after the break. Let's get a little. Have we got time for some of this Bush sound? Okay. He's in Africa, the country, as he puts it, of Africa. Actually, he was in Tanzania. African countries being some of the few places on earth that still tolerate his presence. Sort of. The whole idea of Africa Command is in the tank right now. It's going to have to remain in Germany because the only country apparently that would go along with the idea of a U.S. military command stationed on that continent was Liberia. So the Bush crime family, Dick Cheney, has decided that Africa Command will remain in Germany for the time being. That, of course, AfricaCom created last year with a view to strengthening U.S. presence in Africa because, well, they've got oil, and it's a good jumping-off place to do all sorts of damage to that part of the world, as Bush calls it. Anyway, U.S. officials talked initially of plans to move the AfricaCom headquarters to Africa, but the opposition has been so great that U.S. troops will stay in Europe. There is a base in Djibouti already for 1,800 U.S. troops, but we're not going to talk about that. Sunday, he met with the president of Tanzania and actually answered a couple of questions from the press, like this one. Mr. President, your visit has come rather late during the end of your presidency, and I would like to know, why is it Tanzania and Africa in general, why are they so important now?
That should have been important from the start of my administration. I'll never forget having a conversation with then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. It was early on in the administration. And we were talking about priorities and matters of emphasis. And she asked me whether or not I really cared about Africa. And my answer to her then is the same answer I will give to you now. Absolutely. It's in our national interests. That America help deal with hopelessness.
Hopelessness.
And it's our moral interests that we help brothers and sisters who hurt.
What? It's international interest. Well, yeah, military bases in Africa and control of all the oil there. But, okay. He had to add the little bit there about the moral interests that we help our brothers and sisters who hurt. A lot has been made about Bush's, quote, efforts, end quote, regarding the AIDS epidemic that is global, but particularly in Africa, and the malaria epidemic that is semi-global, but particularly destructive in on the continent of Africa. And Bush's interest in this has been anything but humanitarian. You know it as well as I do. It has to do with drug companies. It has to do with priming the pump, so to speak, so that after Bush had made a big display of being so interested in the health and well-being of various Africans, he could then show up and say, oh, by the way, we would like to establish military commands here in Ghana and here in South Africa and here in Liberia and here in Congo and here in Rwanda and here in, you know, on and on and on. The Bush crime family never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, ever commits an act of decency simply because it's an act of decency or compassion or caring. Never, ever. In fact, no Republican in the current crop of these miserable bastards ever would consider a simple act of human compassion or decency because it is the decent and compassionate thing to do. That is, as Nancy Pelosi says, off the table for these rat bastards. The only reason any efforts were made to ease the suffering in Africa was A, to give a payback to the pharmaceutical companies. No, that's B. A is to show up later and say, oh, by the way, we want to establish a military presence here, a very large military presence. Don't forget, I sent you the AIDS drugs. Welcome back. We have some more Bush for you, but I want to get to Judge Robert Sommer first, Federal Judge Robert Sommer, I believe that's how it's pronounced. And having mentioned it during the first hour, I got this email from Heather who writes, I hope you are not going to take the ignorant tack of claiming that Bob Sommer is just another closeted Republican. I worked at the same firm with him for more than 20 years ago in my first job after law school. I did not have the opportunity to work directly with him very much, but the little contact I had with him confirmed to me that he was very intelligent, very decent. He treated me with much more respect than many of his partners, not to mention far too many other lawyers I worked with at other firms. I do not practice bankruptcy law, and I've never appeared before Judge Sommer. However, until his resignation, he was the judge in charge of a case that I was interested in. So I asked one of my clients, who specializes in bankruptcy law at a very high level, about Judge Sommer. He told me that the judge was highly respected and that he was very creative in coming up with solutions to treat everyone, both bankrupts and creditors, as fairly as possible. Bankruptcy judges are appointed by the federal court, not by the president. I have no idea what Bob Sommer's politics are, but I would be surprised if he were a right-wing Republican. In any event, I do not believe that right-wing politics would be a requirement to be appointed in this state or this circuit. I hope that you will show him the decency that my experience leads me to believe that he would show you. Heather and her last name. Well, Heather, I have no axe to grind with Judge Sommer, and as far as not being appointed by the president, the Boston Globe says he was appointed by the president, so you can pay your money and take your pick there. What is interesting to me about Judge Sommer is the fact that he was involved in a what they call in Massachusetts DWI, driving while intoxicated. His Mercedes sedan hit a pickup truck from behind about 11:30 p.m. on February 6th, according to a police report. No one was hurt. I don't think that George Bush would be appointing anyone to anything who was not. I mean, he's had 7 years to prove, Heather, that he only appoints people, whether it's to federal judgeships, bankruptcy courts, a traffic crossing guard, or an ambassador to Finland. He only appoints people who suck up to the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. That's all Bush has done. I defy you or anyone to tell me of an appointee during the Bush crime family's reign of terror in this country that was not an extreme right-winger. Consequently, because of what happened after his traffic stop, he becomes of deep interest to me. Sommer, who lives in Newbury, Massachusetts, when asked for his driver's license, fumbled in his purse before handing it to the officer who later arrested him, the police report shows. The officer wrote in his report, quote, he had a difficult time locating his license in his purse. He passed over it multiple times before removing it, end quote. The officer offered no other details with regard to the judge's attire or accessories, nor would representatives of the Manchester Police Department or the city solicitor's office, which worked out the negotiated plea agreement with Sommer's lawyer. But other people, like the Boston Globe, did offer those details, of which Audrey Hepburn would have been proud. To wit, when authorities removed him from the vehicle, they said he wore a black woman's cocktail dress, fishnet stockings, and high heels. In his mugshot, the judge appears to be wearing blue eyeshadow. Way to wreck a really chic look, Robert. And where, you might ask, was the judge going that night dressed that way? Sommer told police he had been at the Breezeway pub, where he had one gin and tonic about 2 hours earlier, the police report reveals. He later said he drank two gin and tonics. The Breezeway pub at 14 Pearl Street bills itself as, quote, New Hampshire's favorite gay and alternative bar, end quote, according to its website. The arresting officer reported Sommer smelled of alcohol, slurred his speech, and fell backwards against the door frame while getting out of his car. The Boston-based judge chose the bar in question, according to local rumor, because his wife Wendy was out of town and no one knew him in New Hampshire. It sounds like Wendy is pretty cool, though. When called by a reporter, she said, quote, "I suspect that he will not be interested in talking to anyone from your newspaper, and I'm his wife," end quote. Sama showed his sense of style to the end. He phoned in his resignation from a vacation spot in the Caribbean. Now, why? Not that there's anything wrong with cross-dressing, or certainly not with being a nice, respectable gay judge. There's nothing wrong with that at all. And I've got the emphasis on the wrong adjective there, obviously, but I'm doing it for effect. What is wrong is are the policies of the Bush crime family in pandering to the right wing in this country that tries to demonize people who happen to be gay or choose a same-sex sex partner, whether they're gay or not, or who decides to cross-dress, i.e. J. Edgar Hoover and Rudy Giuliani. It is the attitude put out there by these right-wing freakoids who say, "Oh, you're going to burn in hell for this," that gets my dander up. So whenever I discover in various media reports that another right-wing nutcase has been caught doing a perfectly fun, normal thing, not something I would necessarily do, although I have dressed up in drag before, but when he gets caught doing it, or when someone gets caught who has been an absolute bastard to gay folk and gets caught seeking same-sex sex encounters, then of course I'm going to give it some attention, because it's the hypocrisy, Heather. So that's why I wanted to bring up Judge Sama, or Soma. I don't think his name is Soma. S-O-M-M-A. That would be Sama, wouldn't it, Kathy? So much for the judge. Before we get back to Bush, who's still in Africa waiting for us to do the rest of the sound bites here, from AfricanPath.com, a website that is all things African. It says here, dated today, the U.S. is reported to have dropped plans to locate the controversial Africa Command on the continent. As only Liberia agreed to host the command, the U.S. has therefore no option but to keep the headquarters in Germany. There has been considerable debate on AFRICOM amongst African blogs. Here's one. Quote, "The question should be asked whether Africa needs AFRICOM, or the question should not be whether Africa needs AFRICOM, but why the U.S. believes it needs to have a military presence in Africa. We should be asking ourselves the following questions. Why does the U.S. feel it needs a military presence in Africa, and what will the U.S. military presence consist of in terms of military hardware and numbers of personnel? How does the U.S. intend to operate, and in what circumstances will its forces be mobilized? In what way will the U.S. military presence dictate or determine the price of Africa's natural resources and who gets access to them? In what way will the U.S. military presence infringe on the internal affairs of independent African countries and determine their foreign policy toward other African Union members? How will the U.S. military presence influence the foreign policy of independent African states toward non-African Union countries such as China? How will the U.S. enhanced military presence infringe on the rights of African citizens? How will AFRICOM impact on continental migration and the rights of millions of Africans without citizenship and the rights of refugees?" And it goes on and on. And then it says, "The about turn by the U.S. government, the decision to not go to Africa, can be seen as a small victory for African sovereignty and the continent's refusal to be drawn into America's, quote, war on terror, end quote, agenda, which is being used as a cover for protecting U.S. commercial interests, such as oil, across the globe." So when the white man George W. Bush shows up in black African countries with his condescending attitude, guess what, George? Let me suggest a website for you.
conservatives love to hate, it's Mike Malloy.
Don't you dare to try and stop us. No one could for long. Searchlight on my trail.
21 past the hour. Back to George Bush in Tanzania with the president of that country, Kikwete, had a press conference. Another reporter asked Mr. Bush about Kosovo's new independence. Listen to Bush's response and tell me, do you think he had problems hearing the answer being fed into his earpiece? And also, during the last soundbite, did you notice the slurring of his words? But here's the question, and listen to the way he answers. Mr. President, do you support Kosovo declaring independence from Serbia, and would the United States recognize it as an independent state?
I suggest you study the Ahtisaari plan, not to be like the, you know, grumpy guy. Our position is that its status must be resolved in order for the Balkans to be stable. Secondly, we have strongly supported the Ahtisaari plan. Thirdly, we are heartened by the fact that Kosovo government
has done what?
Has clearly proclaimed its
what?
Willingness and its desire
to
support Serbian rights in Kosovo.
And what else do you believe?
We also believe it's in Serbia's interests.
To do what?
To be aligned with Europe. And the Serbian people can know that they have a friend in America.
Ah, okay.
Finally, the United States will continue to work with our allies to...
To what?
Do the very best we can to make sure there's no violence.
Yeah.
And so those are the principles going into...
Where?
The Kosovo issue.
Ah, thank you. The Ahtisaari plan? Why didn't the reporter say, Mr. Bush, I don't know what the Ahtisaari plan is. In 10 million words or less, can you explain it to me? Bush spent President's Day in Africa, where his presidency is actually somewhat respected by somebody. Now, until Barack Obama fever hit that part of the world, that's when it stopped. Anyway, he gives an interview here with the Today Show's Ann Curry. And Ann Curry lobbed several softballs at Raisin Brain. Get out the insulin for this question. She says, first, you know, even your critics, Mr. Bush, say that you have had the greatest impact on Africa than any president in U.S. history. You have fought for funding and saved more than a million lives from malaria and from AIDS. What moved you? What moved you to care so much about Africa?
I believe to whom much is given, much is required, and our nation has been given a lot, and we're required not only to help folks at home, but when we see needless suffering, to help people abroad. And malaria is a disease that can be stopped, and HIV/AIDS is a disease that can be arrested. And so,
when you know that people have lived because of this decision,
yeah, I know that it touched me. You were at the hospital today. We saw a little boy who had malaria. You know, probably would have died 5 years ago. Today lives thanks to the generosity of the American people. You can't help but weep when you think about what that mom would have gone through had it not been just for some simple gestures by our taxpayers.
Oh, my God. Stop me before I rip my eyeballs out and open veins. I can't believe, first of all, that Ann Curry is doing for George right on camera what Monica did for Bill Clinton. It's incredible. He says we're required not only to help folks at home. When do the Katrina victims get the help, you psycho son of a bitch? What are you talking about? And he starts out by saying, I believe to whom much is given, much is required. Oh, is that from the Quran? No. So Bush wants to give them lots of U.S. military bases and U.S. controlled oil refineries. You know, the AIDS help and the malaria help, as righteous as it might be, is not the prime motivator of George W. Bush. That's not the reason the American taxpayer, as he puts it, was so generous.
You know, he weeps for the little boy who died, who might have died from malaria. I have an idea. Maybe we ought to send those infected mosquitoes to Iraq so all the little children will get malaria, and he'll stop killing them then, and that, he'll start crying about them.
That's true. And he'll send, instead of sending bombs and death and destruction and destabilization, he will send anti-malarial medicine. Good point. All right, we have a couple more, but we also have to break. Damn, these breaks are coming fast tonight. And I've got people who have been holding on for 2 hours here. I'm sorry. I've got to finish these Bush comments, and then we'll take your phone calls. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Is evil. These are evildoers. They have no justification.
So kill them! Who are we talking about, by the way? Oh, them! Yeah, kill them!
Back to the interview with the Today Show's Ann Curry from Arusha, Tanzania. The next question posed by this rough, tough journalist was posed to both Mensa Man and the Xanax Queen of Crawford, Texas. Miss Curry says, I'm wondering to some degree, Mrs. Bush, you've been here 5 times. This has been kind of it's been a major mission for you. Did you push this man? Did you make him do this?
It all came from him. It really did. I mean, when he announced at that State of the Union in 2003 that he wanted the United States to make this big commitment to HIV/AIDS, that came out of his office. And I was thrilled to have the opportunity to get to come to Africa to represent the United States after that, to see all these really wonderful programs.
He's giving you all the credit.
He
I don't deserve
it.
The credit. We had a staff, Condi and Mike Gerson and a bunch of people that really, you know, pushed me inside the White House. I didn't need much pushing, though.
Yeah.
It's in our interest that we deal with hopelessness, and it's our moral interest that we help. And this has been a labor of love. I told people we're on a mission of mercy.
It is God's work.
I think it is.
A network news anchor said it is God's work? No, Ann! It's the work of the Department of Defense, you halfwit!
It's in our interest, Mr. Bush says, that we deal with hopelessness. You create hopelessness. You're a font of hopelessness. You are the headwaters of hopelessness. No, it's in your interest, Mr. Bush, that you deal with the petroleum problem, you know. The Chinese have some of their navy patrolling off the coast of Liberia or Nigeria to protect the oil interests there. So yes, Mr. Bush, you are so damn concerned about those black Africans, aren't you? You are just so concerned about malaria and HIV/AIDS. Oh, dear God, yes, you really are. It wasn't in the least way a bait and switch. It was to have nothing to do with establishing a prominent, powerful U.S. military presence on the continent of Africa. Right, Mr. Bush? I'm sorry, sub-Saharan Africa. You know, that guy, what's his name, up in Libya. He's got all the Libyan oil tied up. Are you in sugar shock yet from this, quote, interview, end quote, with Ann Curry? Then here's a bit more, gentle listener. Did you know the war in Iraq was just a clever jobs program to boost the U.S. economy? You didn't? Well, Ann Curry from NBC, or ABC, NBC? The Today Show, NBC, continues. She says, Mr. President, you know, I know, that it helps that you've got the support with your children and your wife on this mission. And I want to mention that your wife has stood up for you on so many issues. She once told me about you when I asked her about how Americans, you know, were upset about the war in Iraq. She basically said, no one suffers more than their president. I hope they know the burden of worry that's on his shoulders every single day for our troops.
Well, what won't leave me is the fact that a mother has lost a son, or a wife has lost a husband, or a husband has lost a wife. I'll forever, you know, carry that with me. On the other hand, I firmly believe that the mission will yield peace. And as people are now beginning to see Iraq is changing, democracy is beginning to take hold. Uh-huh. And I'm convinced 50 years from now, people look back and say, thank God there was those who were willing to sacrifice.
But you're saying you're going to have to carry that burden. You're saying you're going to have to carry that burden. Some Americans believe that they feel they're carrying the burden because of this economy. The economy,
yeah, well,
they say, is suffering because of this
war. I don't agree with that.
You don't agree with that? It has nothing to do with the economy, the war? The spending
on
the
war? I don't think so. I think actually the spending on the war might help with jobs.
Yeah,
because we're buying equipment and people are working. I think this economy is down because we built too many houses.
What? Quick, Kathy, put away the sharps. This ass just said, I think the economy is down because we built too many houses? But I thought houses fought terrorism. I thought they hated us because we bought houses. That's what you used to say. And now houses are bad too. The economy sucks because, you heard it, we built too many houses. Oh, God. Hide the knives.
Didn't he used to say that the terrorists hated us because we bought homes?
Yeah.
That's why they hated us, because we had the freedom to buy a house. But now, since we wanted to buy the houses, but now we have too many houses.
Now, let's get this straight.
Wonder how many oranges we have.
Bush's illegal invasion, slaughter, occupation, and exploitation of the Iraqi people is an American jobs program? Who said he didn't have a good economic policy? Son of a bitch, front and center. Who said that? Who said that back there? Come up here. Come up here. Get up here. You said that Bush didn't have a good economic policy? The man caused two wars because spending on the war helps with jobs. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And Ann Curry, to her everlasting credit, says, oh, yeah? And Bush says, yeah, because, you know, we're buying equipment. Equipment? Guns, bombs, tanks, bullets, death, napalm, cluster bombs, equipment? And people are working. People are working? People are working. Oh, you sick little bastard. Skipping some more happy talk about the war, Ann Curry did manage, yes?
I just have to interrupt and say, so just according to this logic, what we need is fewer homes and more war. Because one would seem to take care of the other.
Yes. You're absolutely right, Catherine. be careful, you're going to wind up as Bush's secretary of something. Skipping some more happy talk about the war, Ann Curry did manage to wrench some kind of endorsement for McCain out of Bush, although I'm sure McCain would rather Bush the lesser would never speak his name. So Ann Curry asks Chucklenuts, I need to also ask you about the McCain campaign. Reportedly today is saying, or at least it's in the news, reportedly, that it wants you to fundraise, but doesn't want you to appear too often. You heard about that?
I haven't heard about it.
You haven't heard about it? You're laughing.
I'm intense. Well,
why are you laughing about it?
Because I find it amusing.
Why? You don't feel a little chagrined by that?
I just, look, I don't know who said it.
You're going to do
I'm
whatever?
I'm sitting in Tanzania. I don't know what the McCain campaign says, but I'll help him in any way I can.
You will.
Absolutely.
In whatever way you can.
He's going to win, too.
Ann Curry says, why are you laughing? And he answers, because I find it amusing. Like, duh, why do you laugh, Bubblehead? Ann Curry. This interview has to go down into the television wannabe anchor Hall of Fame. Mrs. Bush, come on now. You pushed him into acting like a human being, right? Come on, you did. You pushed him into this. This miserable little coked out bastard can't excuse me, Mrs. President. I'm sorry. I lost my control there. I'm an NBC news person, you know. This miserable little bastard. Oh, I did it again. I'm sorry, Mrs. Bush. This little man would never have thought to save the poor, starving, dark people over here without you giving him a push, right? No. I didn't push him. Here, Ann, you need a break. Would you like one of my Xanax and a little hit off this flask I have? That'll calm you down. You network news people are always so intense. You really are. You need to take a break. I mean, here we are in Tanzania. And there's a swimming pool over here. And if you want to come over here with me, we'll have a drink and do a couple Xanax. And I got some Camel Lights that the boys brought with me on Air Force One. Would you like a Camel Light? You know what I do sometimes? I tear off the filters. I like you, Ann Curry. Who do you work for again? NBC. Oh, that's good.
Imaginary WMD. Classifying facts, exposing secret agents, facts that for the wealthy leave and all the poor behind. I am the egghead. I'm the commander. I'm the decider. Cuckoo.
I'm the decider, and I decide what is best, and what's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain as the Secretary of Defense.
Sitting in a White House garden, talking to the Lord. But my thoughts would be busy, busy hatching if I only had a brain. I am the egghead. I'm the commander. I'm the decider. Cuckoo.
I got you.
People who hate. You know what they hate? They hate the idea that somebody can go buy a home.
You miserable little creep.
My favorite. I miss the days now. I'm going to miss him so much when he's gone. But I miss when he used to talk about how the oceans had let us down.
That's
they
right.
Just weren't doing their job.
That's right. You know, I wonder why on mainstream media, television primarily, why they didn't present the soundbite that Kathy cut from his interview with Ann Curry that we presented. The one about the economy is down because we built too many houses. Now, why didn't CNBC pull that off and play it over and over and over all day? Why didn't CNN cut the one that says the spending on the war might help with jobs? You know, in the space of about 8 seconds, this miserable son of a bitch made two statements that should require his impeachment, because it shows the depth, the breadth, the width of his idiocy and his incompetence. And my God, nobody, where did you hear this? Did you hear this on any other talk program? Did you hear this on television? Have you heard it on NPR? Have you heard it on radio news reports? I'm really curious. Or is the only place on the whole goddamn planet that you'll hear this is on this radio program? That the war in Iraq is a jobs program, and the reason the economy is down is because we built too many houses. No, Bush. The economy is down because of your sick, miserable policies and the willingness of capitalist fund managers to be predatory monsters and destroy the system. Not because we built too many houses. Why? Why is this sound not played anyplace else except here?
I heard the bit about the jobs on NPR today. Just heads up before you start getting the flood of email. I did actually hear it in the car, so.
Oh. Never mind. Got an email from Razor Bunnies. I love that. Razor Bunnies. Oh, my God. Razor Bunnies writes, you spoke of President Bush caring about the children that are infected and have died from malaria infections. You may or may not remember that there are serious cholera outbreaks in Iraq. This could be fixed with a grand public service called water filtration, chlorine. Maybe the chlorine is banned because it has been used for dirty bombs in Iraq. Either way, cholera is a nasty, horrible death, and there are many infected in Iraq in recent past because of what this administration is doing or not doing. I do remember, Razor Bunny. Trust me, there is not much criminal activity that this filthy administration participates in that of which I am not aware. When Bush talks about, I'm kind of compassionate, you know. It's just my Christian upbringing. I looked at all these dead little black children over here, and I thought, well, that's, no, we got to do something about that. Plus, the AIDS program will be a wonderful pipeline of tax money that my friends can siphon off millions of dollars, which they have effectively done. But I'll talk about it. It makes me look good and have pictures on the walls in my presidential library showing me helping all the little black children over here. What? The children in Iraq? Screw them. Cholera? What is cholera? Cholera? What is it? Cholera? What is that? What is that? What is cholera? Oh, it's a disease? What? It's because we bombed all the water filtration plants and facilities in Iraq. Really? But Dick tells me that Kellogg, Brown, and Root have replaced those. Or Halliburton. You know the war in Iraq is really a jobs program? Sorry I didn't get to your calls tonight. Thanks to the crew. Ian Huff, who engineered, Billy Foster, our technical director, Ben Birch, our podcast manager, Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent, Bob Alexander, our resident philosopher, Bridget Wolf, our writer in residence, even though she doesn't live here. And don't forget, and Catherine Bay, our executive producer, she who must be obeyed. And remember, Phoenix Truth Seekers, and in the surrounding area, please come and meet Scott Ritter and me. This Saturday, February 23rd, 6 p.m., at a facility that we refuse to announce because we're afraid that the CIA will show up with sharpshooters. But you can get all the information at 1480kphx.com. And Kathy, we haven't gotten an update from the boss, John Manzo, about the availability of tickets. There are still tickets available, I would imagine, right? I don't know. So go to 1480kphx.com. And one last thing, to all the people who send me emails about Air America, assuming that I am part of Air America, once again, for the umpteenth time, I am not. I was fired by Air America for either my position on Israel or the fact that they needed to save money and decided to let people after 7 o'clock, like Sam Cedar and me, go. Take your pick on that one, whatever you want to believe. But my program, that is partially owned by the Nova M Radio Network, is carried on a lot of stations that carry what remains of Air America programming. But trust me, I am in no way connected with Air America Radio, which some might see as proof that there is a God. I'll see you tomorrow night. Thanks for hanging out. I do appreciate it. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.